This is The After Party, live with Kim McAllister. Pick a couch, grab a drink, and settle into the conversation.
Everybody, hello. It is The After Party Live, the hour where we just kind of mellow out and relax a little bit. Aloha to you. It is Travel Tuesday, and I kind of felt like taking a bit of a beach trip today. So we're going to the Caribbean together, and that is in the Travel Tuesday segment. It's kind of making me really look forward to Tuesdays to see where we can go. There's also some interesting things going on cruise ships, not the falling off that Mark was talking about, but some interesting new rides that I don't think I would have the stones to go on, and a really cool new water slide. We'll talk about all of that coming up. I sent out a message yesterday to everyone who basically has ever contributed to the show via PayPal, letting you all know where the new information can be found regarding the new PayPal page. And I'm really hoping that it didn't come off as kind of like one of these fundraising emails that I get every day from President Biden or whomever else. But I have received a few emails of people saying, what happened? My old payment was canceled, and where can I find your new? So that's why I sent that out, just to let you guys know that it is there. It is also in the show description. And on YouTube, if you click the About tab, you'll find it there as well. So a lot of places. But if you have any questions at all, please feel free to email me, kim@theafterparty.live. And thank you for all the ways that you support the show, even if that's just hanging out with me for an hour. Hugely appreciate you. Aloha, Jim. Thank you for being here. Aloha, Vanessa. Yeah. Hey, Cecilia. Aloha. Thank you for hanging out, and please click the like button. We need the likes and we need the subscribes. And if you see the short video tab, if you can ever just go through and click like or comment on something that you happen to have found interesting, that helps bump those up in the ratings as well. When they get bumped up in the ratings, more people see them, more people subscribe to the show. And while I love this sweet kind of smaller group that we have here, because we all kind of know each other and it's really very comfortable, we do need to kind of get the show growing a little bit in order for it to keep going. So thanks for doing that if you have the time and you are so inclined. All right, we're going to jump into this Travel Tuesday. But first, let's talk about the story that I just saw regarding the president's daughter. So this is Ashley Biden. And I don't know if you've been following this case at all. Here's President Biden and his daughter. She had her diary stolen. Yeah, it's not good. A Florida woman stole it and sold it. It belonged to President Biden's daughter. I forgot how to speak, apparently. But now this woman is going to be spending a month in prison. Apparently, that's what it's worth to steal someone's private personal thoughts. A judge in New York handing down this sentence today, calling for 3 years of supervised release as well. So a month in prison, 3 years probation? The owner of a house that Ashley Biden had been living in allowed her to keep the items there after she left in 2020. A federal prosecutor said Amy Harris then found the items after she moved in and conspired with another defendant to sell them. They were going to sell her diary. Harris and the other defendant admitted to receiving $20,000 from the conservative activist group Project Veritas for those items. So the woman that found it, sold it, she gets a month behind bars and 3 years of probation. And that doesn't seem like enough. No. Did you see this story? This is out of SF Gate, so that there's a high likelihood that you may have seen it. They're moving this last houseboat across the bay, the entire home, going down the bay. It's a large wood-shingled two-story home that was being towed by a much smaller boat. And this happened on Sunday. It left from the Docktown Marina in Redwood City, headed towards Sausalito. The Coast Guard says they were never notified. But they were made aware after a lot of people called and said, do you know this house is being towed across the bay? So they're monitoring it. It started on Sunday. It was still in transit as of yesterday afternoon, but they were watching the progress there. They say with a vessel that requires a large berth, it's really best practice to notify the Coast Guard so that they can alert other boats or vessels in the area to give it plenty of space. So this houseboat was the second to last floating home at the Redwood City Marina. At one point, 100 people or more lived there. And in 2015, nearby homeowners filed a lawsuit against the city. And the city settled with that group and then declared liveaboards were illegal. So nearby homeowners did not want these houseboat people there. And ever since then, there's been this effort to evict them. Now they're down to just one solo houseboat in Redwood City. Docktown residents tried to avoid eviction. They filed lawsuits fighting back, but no. The city is paying these people to get out. So this particular houseboat is set to be docked at Waldo Point Harbor in the Commodore Marina right near the Richardson Bay Bridge. You don't hear about these moving very often. I mean, obviously they can and they float, but really once you dock them, they kind of stay there, right? And a lot of them actually are put on trucks and travel by land. But yeah, you can move it by water as well. And so here it goes, but that was quite a sight. Sayonara, off of Redwood City you go. Let's get to animals because there's some good animal stories today. Check this one out. This lady, I mean, I guess you live in Florida. You maybe kind of expect these things. I don't know. This Florida woman found a nearly 8 foot tall or 8 foot long, I should say, alligator. Tall would be crazy. Inside of her home. She said she's in her home in Venice's Grand Palm community when she hears a banging at her front screen door. I thought, she said, it's somebody who didn't live here trying to get into the wrong house. So she said, I got up off the couch and I came around the door prepared to say, you're in the wrong place. She said she had two thoughts when she saw the source of the sound. One, oh my gosh, I have an alligator in my house. And two, oh my gosh, I have an alligator in my house and how am I going to get rid of him? So she calls 911. She ends up taking the combined efforts of several sheriff's deputies, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission officers, to get this big old alligator out of her house. She thinks that it traveled from a pond nearby and forced its way through her door. But she said this alligator had to go through 2 yards, cross the street, and then come into her house. She said nobody saw him, and it was quite a surprise. Can you imagine having that thing in your house? I'm telling you, you Florida people, Wes, you're strong. How about this little one? It's called an okapi. Pretty cute. Newborn little okapi birth at the San Diego Zoo Safari Park. Okapis are known as the forest giraffe or zebra giraffe. And apparently, they are the closest relative to the giraffe. Yeah. This is a male okapi. Again, the only living relative of the giraffe. And he doesn't have a name yet, but he likes to lie in the sun and run around in the grass. His mom is very attentive, watching him, making sure that he's resting, tucking him away. Nursing him, cozying up in the evenings. They sleep in the same room, so it's really sweet. Look at that little okapi. I've never seen one in real life. I guess have to go to the San Diego Zoo Park to check him out. Yeah, interesting looking creature. How about this pygmy slow loris? Kind of a weird looking little creature. They buried the lead with this story. Let me tell you that. Because this pygmy slow loris is really adorable, but it's also really deadly. tell you that these are endangered, the pygmy slow loris. They're considered endangered by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. They live mostly in evergreen forests of Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam. And they face threats, habitat loss, logging. They are used in traditional medicine, and people steal them, right? They look like little teddy bears. How cute is that little creature? However, the people don't understand about the pygmy slow loris. They do not make good pets. Apparently, they have a venomous thing that they do. They have, they guests come to the small mammal house apparently to see them, and they have the opportunity to learn about this unique venomous primate. They apparently have this venom that paralyzes you, right? I mean, it's kind of scary because they look so cute, and all of a sudden they bite you and you're completely incapacitated. They do it to larger creatures and people as well, incapacitating large predators, including humans. Now, they don't eat us. They primarily feast on tree sap. They're also very sensitive, but they are the only primate known to produce venom. I guess I can understand that in a evolutionary way. I mean, they're small, they're delicate. They would have to have something to protect themselves. They're called deadly fluff balls by some. The pygmy slow loris. So this one was born at the Smithsonian's National Zoo and Conservation Biology Institute. This 3-year-old pygmy slow loris had 2 newborn babies, and they are the first of their endangered species born at that zoo. The pygmy slow loris, again, endangered and a big target for wildlife traffickers and the pet trade. Seriously, you want a primate that has a venom to incapacitate you? That's what you want? People are weird in what they're looking for in a pet, let me tell you. And these pygmy slow lorises are really hard to keep as pets too. They have a lot of medical needs and nutritional needs. And apparently this illegal pet trade has really hit their population hard in the wild. So they don't really make good pets. They're very hard to take care of, and they'll bite the hell out of you and paralyze you for a while with their venom. Not good. Nobody wants that. But boy, sure is cute. Look at those big eyes. Just don't get too close. No, no, no. They're doing something interesting in the Bay Area. Well, actually Pacific Grove, so the Monterey Bay Area. When it comes to keeping away the seagulls, and if you've ever lived along the coast, you know seagulls can be a real hassle. They're beautiful and, you know, part of the whole chain of life and food chain and whatnot, but they can be really annoying. So in Pacific Grove, they are trying to keep the seagulls from expensive rooftop equipment, HVAC units, keep the rooftops clean from contaminants that could enter storm drains like seagull poop, reducing the need for rooftop cleaning, getting rid of the smell, and minimizing all the bird noise. Because if you have birds on your roof, it's a loud cacophony. I remember in high school in the Santa Cruz area, at lunch they would come because they knew that everyone had food. And so people would run for cover because these birds would just fly over and dive bomb people. And, you know, seagull poop would fly everywhere. So the city of Pacific Grove starts this abatement in an effort to keep seagulls from public places within the city, and they're doing it by using birds of prey. So they're dragging out these hawks. They've got hawk wranglers, Harris hawks, and they've got falconers and other birds of prey coming in the next coming weeks as well. And they're using these birds of prey to deter these seagulls from nesting on rooftops, rummaging through trash, littering, leaving their unwanted droppings everywhere. You know? It's like they say, if you don't want mice, get a cat. If you don't want the seagulls on your roof, maybe hire a falconer with a hawk, is what they're doing. There's a problem with wolf hybrids. I don't know if you saw this story. Apparently, this is in the Sierra, and there are a group of these wolf hybrids. So that's either huskies or malamutes that had been bred with wolves. And they belonged to a local resident, and apparently they got out. There's six of them. They are roaming around in Shingletown in the Sierra like a pack of wild dogs, which they are. And apparently the article that I'm reading from News Nation says these wolf hybrids have gone feral on the loose in Shingletown. They also say Shingletown is in Northern California, an area in Northern California. Yeah. So, but it's in Shasta County, right? Six of these wolf-type animals remain in the wild. Apparently, they've been actively working to capture them at the Shasta County Sheriff's Office. They killed someone else's dog, so they've got a problem there with these animals. They are determined to be wolf, husky, malamute hybrids that belong to a local resident. That person has been cited for having unlicensed, unvaccinated animals and strays on their property. They were also cited for violating kennel violations. It's not illegal to own a wolf hybrid, but it does vary by region. You have to, though, have them registered, right? In some areas, it's okay. In some areas, it's not okay. At this point, they're going to keep looking for them. They think it's going to be a real challenge to find them. The animal officers have set up a bunch of traps. They are staying on patrol. They're telling people to be very careful, protect themselves, protect your pets, protect your livestock until these six animals are captured. Now that's what's going on in Shingletown in Northern California. The vast and varied Northern California. Please click the like button. Please click the subscribe button as well. And I promise, Lori, this will be a very quick, brief mention, but I thought it was interesting that someone took the time to do a study on Swifties. And it turns out this casino.org study counted the number of Swifties that attended the Eras Tour, the number of Eras Tour shows that were held in each city, looked at Taylor Swift Google search in each area, the number of TikTok posts regarding Taylor Swift in each area, face group members in dedicated Taylor Swift groups, and the number of Taylor Swift themes events on Facebook and Eventbrite. And what they found is, and now they only looked at the cities where the Eras Tour was held, but what they found is Santa Clara is the Swifty capital of the United States, with more Swifties per capita than any other city. And of course, Santa Clara, Levi's Stadium, that's where the Eras Tour was held when it came to the Bay Area. They renamed it Swifty Clara. The fans in Santa Clara, well, I would argue the entire Bay Area, are the top tier when it comes to Swifties. And they looked at other cities as well. So Santa Clara takes the top spot, then comes Tampa Bay, Pittsburgh, and Kansas City. I don't necessarily know if this is super accurate, because if you're only looking at the cities where the Eras Tour was held, I mean, a lot of people travel for these shows, right? So there may be people from the Bay Area that went to see the show at SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles. Someone that couldn't get tickets here that maybe went to another city, had a little vacation. So casino.org, I don't know about your study, but we'll take it. Santa Clara, we'll take our Swifty capital of the world, right? Let's talk about Roman stuff. Roman stuff. There was a villa found in the UK. And in the villa, they found it full of coins and jewelry and curse tablets. It was discovered at this housing and development area in England, and the buildings there may be nearly 2,000 years old. It was a richly decorated Roman villa, and during excavations in the English countryside, archaeologists found it. It had some pretty funky artifacts, miniature axes and scrolls that may have once been used, they think, in rituals. This happened, or this was found, in the village of Grove, which is about 60 miles west of London. This area has been occupied since the Bronze Age. This newly discovered complex wasn't built until Britain's Roman era. It included several hall-like aisle buildings dating back to the 1st and 2nd centuries CE, as well as a winged corridor villa. The sheer size of the buildings, they say, still survive, and the richness of goods recovered suggests that it was a very dominant feature in this area, if not the wider landscape. So this villa had a main hall. It connected multiple rooms, likely built before the neighboring aisle buildings, which were larger structures, and may have been added as the owner's wealth continued to increase. One of the buildings had multiple levels and was so imposing that it was probably visible for miles. What I don't understand is, if it was this big and there's been development here over the years, how did they not know about it before? It's like it was there the whole time and you just now found it? It was embellished with painted plaster, mosaics, ornate tile work, colonnades, brick floors, and other ornamentations as well. And when they started digging, they found artifacts, brooches, rings, coins, tableware, a belt buckle decorated with horses. They think the belt buckle dates back to 350 to 450 CE and may have belonged to a member of the Roman elite. And the artifacts suggest that Romans occupied this area through the 4th or 5th century. They're saying this site is much more complex than a regular site, and that it was a very important center for activities. Check this out, this little tiny axe that they found there. Like, what would they do with that? They think it was maybe used in rituals of some type. Maybe this was a small administrative center. They don't know. They don't know where all the people that were there ended up. But they do say the complex may contain a burial area. And some curious objects found during the excavation may provide clues to what they were doing there, and maybe their spiritual practices as well. So they found those tightly coiled scrolls, lead scrolls. And when they straightened them out, the scrolls resembled what they call Roman curse tablets, where the Romans would write messages to higher powers. They also found these miniature votive axes, similar to a collection of miniature weapons once found in a different city, thought to have been offered to gods like Mercury. So an offering, right? Well, good thing they found it all, because there's a planned housing development going in. It's called Brookside Meadows. It's going in right on top of it all. So the hope is that they'll understand what happened there. The locals will understand the history. They say it's remarkable to think we are simply the latest in a line of people who have established a community right on this site. I mean, if that was here, this would be, you know, preserved. It would be, don't you think? It would be a museum. It would be cordoned off. Kids would file by on field trips. Here, it's like another day at the office. Oh, Roman villa, ancient Roman villa with tiny axes. Well, pull it all out and pave it over. I'm telling you. This is it. You know, I got to have my lotto story of the day. And I love these accidental lottery winners. This guy, he accidentally bought two identical Powerball tickets. Meant to push one, accidentally got two out. So when he won $1 million, He actually won $2 million because he had two tickets. I mean, seriously. This man in Annapolis, Maryland, said he went to a 7-Eleven and he used the lottery terminal's replay feature. And that scans your old ticket for winners, and then it prints you a new ticket with the same numbers that you had on your old ticket. And he didn't consider that his stack of tickets included some bearing the same sets of numbers, so he said he ended up with a couple of duplicates on accident. So he buys his tickets. He brought his tickets back to scan, and he heard then, a couple days later, that 7-Eleven sold two $1 million winning tickets. He said he realized he had duplicates for four of his tickets that won $4 each. But then he said, when he scanned a ticket that matched the first five numbers from the drawing, he got a $1 million prize. And he called his wife. He's like, I just won $1 million. He said, we had our crying moment. And 20 minutes after that, when I put the ticket down, I went back to the other tickets, he said. He said, I still have tickets to go through. What if I have the second $1 million ticket? And then he figures out he does indeed have the second $1 million ticket. I mean, what are the chances that you win $1 million twice at the same lottery pull? He said, it was mind-blowing. I had no idea I doubled it. What are they going to do with the $2 million? They say they're going to invest it. So, okay. Well done. And I can't even win what most I think I've won recently is $4. It's all right. This story I find fascinating. It's about Vikings. And it turns out they may have used body modification as a sign of identification. There was a recent study that looked at Scandinavian examples of filed down teeth and elongated skulls dating back to the Viking age. They also have these altered bones that apparently belong to island-dwelling Vikings. And the thought is, archaeologists say, that it could be purposeful body modifications. The study on this is in the current Swedish Archaeology Journal. It may be part of social rituals of initiation? Don't know. Historians thought that tattooing was the only form of body modification used by Scandinavians in the Viking Age. But now, they're not so sure because they've got a couple other forms beginning to change the thoughts on this, like filed teeth and elongated skulls. Here's a picture. I would think the filed teeth maybe had to do with cavities or tooth pain, but perhaps not. Maybe it was some type of body modification they were doing. You can see the teeth filed down here right in the front. And this is a skull from a woman in this era that it appears had been purposely elongated. Now they say both forms of body modification had attention in other cultural contexts, but these in the Viking Age society are still being investigated exactly why. So they looked into 130 men, the remains, with horizontal furrows carved into their teeth. Many of them were found on the Swedish island of Gotland. They also looked at three cases of modified skulls, all belonging to women on that island. And then they decided to look into getting a better understanding of why these body modifications were performed and what they might have meant in the Viking Age. And they're still looking into it. They're not quite sure, but they think they did it on purpose. So, maybe religious, social, cultural affiliation to identify you as part of a group? The dental work may have been linked to trading activity, they say. Maybe the grooves functioned as a rite of initiation or a sign of identification for a closed group of merchants that was a precursor maybe to later merchant guilds. They're still looking into it. How interesting is that? Yeah. I'm going to move to this story about California counties. This study was done about the best California counties to live in. And it's really, really long, so I won't go into it, but I'm all into all of it. I'll just kind of give you the overview on the top stories, the top counties. But the study was done by this group called Stacker. And they made this list of the best counties to live in California using rankings from a website called Niche, N-I-C-H-E, Niche. And it ranked counties by various factors. And that includes how good are the public schools in the county? How easy is it to get an education? What's the cost of living? What's the housing like? And so they have the best counties to live in California. And they list 30. There's 58 counties in California and 30 are listed. But I didn't want to do all 30 because it's really, really long. So I'm just going to give you the top five counties. And this article can be found, by the way, in the Press Democrat. So number five on the list is, that's Marin County. Number five. And you would think it wouldn't have made the list because it's probably one of the most expensive counties on the list, right? But number five it is. Overall rank, 150. The population, 260,485. The median income in Marin, $142,000. And the median home value, $1.2 million. If you're going to try to rent, which 36% of people do in Marin, the median rent is $2,487. The top public schools, Redwood High School, Ross Elementary, Tamil Pius High, all get an A-plus grade. They've got really good private schools there, too. Marin Academy, the Branson School. The top places in Marin County, Corte Madera, San Anselmo, and Larkspur, all with a grade of A-plus. Number four on the list, Orange County. Orange County, California. The population, 3,175,000 and change. Median household income, 109K. Median home value, $862,000. Median rent, a little more than $2,200. 43% of people in Orange County rent it. They've got some great schools, great private schools. Top places, Irvine, Woodbridge, and University Park. Next on our list, at number three, Santa Clara County. Look at that. Santa Clara County ranks number three. 1,916,831 people live in Santa Clara County. $153,000 a year is the median income. Median home value, $1.3 million. Henry Gunn, M. Gunn High School, Palo Alto High, Saratoga High, all looking good. Top places, Evergreen Park, College Terrace, and University South. Those are the neighborhoods they like. Number two, best counties to live in California. That's San Mateo County. San Mateo County makes the list because it has a population of 754,000 people, a median household income of just about 150K a year, a median home value of 1.4 million, rents about 2,800, Aragon High, Mills High, Carlmont High, great schools. Top places, Foster City, Belmont, and Burlingame. And the top county to live in California might be a little surprising, I think. It is Alameda County. That's right. Top county to live in California with a population of 1,663,000 people. A median income of 122,000, a median home value of 999K. Your rent's going to be a little more than 2,200. Amador Valley High, Foothills High, Piedmont High all get top grades. Top places, North Berkeley, Elmwood District, and Downtown Berkeley. So I guess Alameda County, doing pretty well. They want to change the name of the Oakland Airport, but best county to live in. So there you have it. It's time. It is for Travel Tuesday. Let's do it. Let's go to the Caribbean first. What do you think? Are you ready? I'm ready. I really want to go to the Caribbean. Maybe we just need a little mental vacation right now. I'm liking it. All right. Let's go to the Caribbean. Our first stop is Mayaro Beach. Oh, yeah. This is an article about the best beaches in the Caribbean and an overlooked island with quite a few of them. So this beach is called Mayaro Beach. It is Trinidad. These beaches are on Trinidad. They say the beaches here are as stunning as any stretch of sand and sea found anywhere in the Caribbean. The 50 plus beaches on Trinidad each have their own special character. And we're going to visit some of them today together. So you have your swim trunks on, got your bikini on in your mind. Let's do it. Mayaro Beach, if you're looking for the perfect place to meet or exceed your daily quota of 10,000 steps, this is a perfect spot. It's a 9-mile long stretch, and surf here limits swimming to the most experienced. A lot of people like to go kiteboarding here because it's kind of windy, but it's really beautiful. Next stop, Manzanilla Beach. That's pretty. Wow. Looks like a little windy here too. Look at all the flags. The Manzanilla Beach, just north of Mayaro, is also great for walking. They have miles of towering coconut palm trees lining the shore. It looks like a deserted beach fantasy. The main attraction at Manzanilla, combing for seashells. They have thick clusters of them laying in piles along the sand. That's my jam. How about we go to Grand Riviere? Mm-hmm. This is Grand Riviere. And it is on the north coast in a very concentrated bay. It's idyllic half-moon coves carved from the jagged, hilly coastline. Grand Riviere stands out as Trinidad's prime sea turtle nesting beach. Not uncommon to find hundreds of leatherback turtles just nesting along Grand Riviere's 1 kilometer of sand. So not the biggest beach, but it is a destination to view the leatherback turtle nesting. And if you're going to do that, they ask that you get a permit. This is my jam over here. Let's go to Maracas Bay. Here it is. Oh, yes, please. And thank you. Maracas Bay Beach. So nice. This is a good one for foodies. It's probably the most popular and best known beach on the island. It is known because U.S. service personnel used to be stationed there during World War II. And the GIs apparently found it so beautiful that they commissioned the construction of what was for a long time the best road in Trinidad so that they could go to and from this beach a little more easily. In later years, Maracas Beach fame grew even more because of the culinary treat. Unfortunately, it's bake and shark. A bacon shark is also sometimes called shark and bake. It's a sandwich. A shark meat sandwich. I'm going to say no thank you. The shark is usually black tip, deep fried. Trinidadian bakes, fluffy fried flour dough treats similar to Johnny cakes are used in place of the bread. And this is where you go to get your shark and bake. I'm going to say no on that. I worry about eating creatures like that and whether they're endangered and whether that's sustainable. And they say, yeah, in more recent times, concerns over sustainability of using black-tip sharks has led to campaigns urging people to think twice about eating the shark and bake. But the beach is sure pretty. How about this one? Las Cuevas Beach. You want to go there? I do. I'll take it. They've got somebody there watching to make sure everybody's safe in the lifeguard tower. Looks good to me. Las Cuevas Beach. It's a little bit east of Maracas, about 15 minutes down the road. And if you would like to hang out and maybe leave the Maracas party scene, get a little more solitude and quiet time in, it's a little more peaceful. The sand, the surf, it's a really good beach for swimming, they say. And it's also the largest beach on Trinidad's north coast. So there you go. This is an interesting looking beach. It's called Down D Islands. Look at that. Interesting, huh? Down D Islands is less known than the others. It's in the country of Trinidad and Tobago. It's compromised, it's comprised, of more than just two of its main land masses. Down D Islands, or DDI for short, makes it pretty easy for you to island hop around offshore parts of Trinidad that most Trinidadians don't even know, they say. The DDI boat excursions are offered by a number of tour companies, and one of the most popular day trips will take you to Gaspar Grande. And once you're there, you can do a low-impact hike to a cave. Well-lit stairs trail down to an underground pond known as the Blue Grotto. If you don't want to do that, then you can just swim around in the bays of Trinidad's uninhabited tiny sister islets. Kind of cool. Places that, you know, you might never thought of going before. This is why we do Travel Tuesday, right? One thing I will say about Trinidad is, again, more than 50 beaches, and unlike other parts of the Caribbean, they are all staffed with lifeguards. So all of the beaches that we just talked about have lifeguard service between the hours of 10 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. So it's safe. Often they have food and drink concessions, beach bars, restrooms, and other facilities at many of their beaches. They even have pretty good Wi-Fi around the shore. So if you can't put your phone down and enjoy the waves crashing on the shore, and you must take all your pictures, well, there's a really good chance you'll be able to do that. Ah, do we feel good? I feel good. Not quite good enough to go on this contraption. No. It's an interesting new water slide, though. Oh, I don't know. It looks like, does it look complicated to you? It's the world's first and only 5-in-1 water slide. It's located at Explore Zipline Park in Riviera Maya, Mexico. They are showcasing the world's first and only 5-in-1 water slide. They call it Toboganzote. Riders start on a 4-person raft, descend from 135 feet up, and highlights along the way include the sphere, the half wave, the whirlpool, and the whirlwind. It's a pulse-pounding freefall, wild twists and turns, dizzying spins, before you splash into a relaxing wave pool at the end. You need the relaxation at the end because your heart's going a mile a minute on the way down. Explore, they say, is where rivers, caves, underground caverns, and now Toboganzote come together in the Riviera Maya. Convergence, they say, we're confident that will delight the visitors. I don't know. This water slide can accommodate more than 1,200 guests a day. And if you're staying at an all-inclusive hotel nearby, the Xcaret Hotels, I guess they let you go down there and do that for, I'm not sure if it's free or an addition or what. 5-in-1, Yeah. I think I can skip it. I think I could also skip this next one. I'm just going to say no. No, no, and no. This is on a cruise ship. And this is a ride I would say is not for the weak at heart. I heard Mark Thompson earlier say, got a bit of a fear of heights there, right? The MSC World America cruise ship is featuring this new over-the-water swing ride. The name of it is the Cliffhanger. It's dangling about 164 feet above the ocean. And so when this MSC World America ship launches next year, they will offer the only overwater swing ride at sea. You climb into one of these rides, 4 seats on the roof, on the top deck of the ship, and the powered arms will then lift you up, out, and over the water, and swing you back and forth over the ocean. I don't think this is where I'm going. I don't know. What do you guys think? I have to show you the video of it. I'm thinking it's a hard no for me. It's a hard pass. But let me show you. I mean, you can see kind of by the picture there. But I have to show you this screen. Because, let's see if I can find it. Because I mean, this is, yeah. Here you go. Take a look at that. It kind of gives you really the, a little bit more of the experience. That's really high up. The cliffhanger, right? Yeah. Let's look at it again. I don't know. What do you think? Are you going? I don't think I'm going. Look at this thing. I mean, you're dangling. I guess you'd be strapped in. If you have a bit of a thrill seeker bone in your body, maybe this is a good thing. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe I'm not much of a traveler. Before we end the show, I wanted to give you some news about an addition to the EU's Schengen area. They have added Romania and Bulgaria partially to Europe's Schengen area. The airports in Romania and Bulgaria removing passport checkpoints for travelers flying within much of Europe. This is a border-free area. And as of this weekend, you have these two countries partially joining the Schengen area. And I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it's an area where you're able to move freely in this spot and dozens of other European countries. And the new policy, they say, will apply to Bulgaria and Romania's air and sea borders. So it's the lifting of internal air and sea border checks. They call it a success for both countries and the largest area of free movement in the world, where you can go from country to country and not have to stop and be checked. The lifting of the border controls only applies to air and sea borders just for the moment. It's not clear as to when the borders on the land checkpoints will be lifted. But both the airports in Romania and Bulgaria removed the passport checkpoints Sunday. This is for travelers flying within much of Europe. The Schengen area includes 27 other countries. It allows travelers to move from country to country without border controls. The addition to expanding this border-free area, the European Commission has postponed the start of this travel authorization fee that they were going to impose until 2025. It's only $7.51, but it will be required for travelers from visa exempt countries, and that includes the United States, in order to enter 30 different European countries. The fee will also apply to travelers visiting both Romania and Bulgaria. So if you're headed to Europe, just some extra news for you. Okay. Huge thank you, by the way, to everyone who has contributed to the show. A lot of people over the last 24 hours, and I just can't tell you how much I appreciate it. As a matter of fact, I just got a contribution from Gary while we're on the air. So thank you to everyone. I so appreciate you taking the time to support the show, your nice comments, your ideas, as well as the stories you send and spending time. Now I get to go back and read everything you guys had to say in the comments. Liz thought that Schengen area required some sort of visa. It may be that it does. And then once you're in, you don't have to get them from all the other countries. So check it out. But I know we have two more countries added to that Schengen list. Knit One Pearl One says, I've never gone on a cruise, but that looks fun. I don't know. Mindy says, have fun until it breaks and you end up swimming in the sea. 164 feet down? Oh. So thank you so much for being here. Until tomorrow, I hope you have a great afternoon. Make it a great day. I'll see you back here for the Nikki Maduro show at 9 a.m. and then Mark Thompson at 11. And tomorrow, John Rothman will be on the show. So that'll be really fun. We also have, I believe, Hal Rudnick on the show. So we'll do that as well. And it's going to be a great one before we meet back here for the big, big party. Okay, everybody, have a great rest of your day. Bye.
The After Party Live would like to thank the following contributors and viewers like you.